This episode is sponsored by 909 Apparel. Now, if you've seen me in the real world, you will know I love a good aviation-themed t-shirt and hoodie. Yet, finding a decent quality top has not always been as easy a process as I would have hoped for. That is until I found 909 Apparel. Named after the famed B-17 Flying Fortress 909, which flew 140 missions without losing a crew member, 909 Apparel's designs celebrate the history and heritage of aviation, something I can totally get behind. And they ensure an exacting level of detail goes into each one of their designs. Now, these designs can take up to 3 months to research and complete, so you can be sure that your passion for aviation is matched by the team at 909. And the great thing is, they're available everywhere. So wherever you're listening to the Damcasters, you'll be able to get a 909 shirt. So check out their link tree to all of their Amazon stores in the description below and get your aviation on.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. The Focke-Wulf FW-200 Condor was quite literally a savage airliner. Originally designed to be Lufthansa's aircraft of choice on its European, transatlantic and South American routes, it became so much more than that. And that is going to be what we're going to be discussing on today's episode with friend of the show, Matt Willis. So we have to delve into what brought Matt to this, because he covers a lot of subjects. Naval aviation history is his thing, is his handle on Twitter. So where did this particular story start? So I suppose this is confession time, that I tend to drag you on these things at the last minute when I realize I need something. So thank you for that. But let's get cracking. Was this a commission, or was this something that you'd wanted to delve into for a while? Because we've talked about this aircraft in the past, but where's the idea for this book come from?
Oh, no, this came from Mortons. This was they approached me to see if I wanted to do it, basically, and this was my first contact with Mortons. So obviously, as things happen, I've had two books with them out prior to this, but that was more a case of once the conversation started, I started talking to them about, well, actually, I have these ideas for fleet air arm books, and are you interested in those? And because I had quite a lot more of that work underway, they were able to get out the door somewhat quicker. But yeah, this was what they originally approached me for, because they were doing this series on Luftwaffe aircraft. Mm-hmm. And I'd done with another author on to MMP books on the Junkers 87. And again, that was not really my traditional area. And that was more that I was, that I'd done so much work on the text that I got, that I was kind of bumped up to co-author. So this is really, I consider this my first Luftwaffe book. It's an aircraft that's interested me in terms of the way it has impacted on the stuff that I've been writing about from the other side. So it's something that I probably always would have got to. And when Mortons approached me about Luftwaffe aircraft, this was one of the ones on their list. And this was like the one that jumped out at me as the one that was natural for me to tackle. Yeah. So that's kind of how it went on. In terms of the book, I feel like I own it now. It doesn't feel like something that I was hired to do. It does feel like a project that was something that I was personally invested in. And that's probably why it took so long, in the way that these things do with me. It was longer than it was meant to be. I took more time than I'd expected writing it, just because there was a lot more there and the story was a lot more interesting, in addition to the fact that it's a German aircraft, so a lot of the sources are in German language. A lot has been written about this aircraft in English, but I like to go beyond that. Yeah, so that's the rambling story of it, really.
Well, let's get into the detail then, because my first knowledge that you were doing this is when you started sharing all of the plates for the different aircraft that are in the middle, which are fantastic, dear listener. But how did Kurt Tank get into the airline business, and Fokker Wolf for that matter? Because I suppose most people will think of Tank and immediately go FW-190. They don't really think of the other aircraft that he produced while at Fokker Wolf's. This is always interesting, because in that very hagiography of his that was written in the 50s, all of this bit's just like a few bits in the middle, isn't it? There's not a lot on his wartime aircraft. But what brought him into this? Was this like, for example, the Heinkel Junkers Dornier aircraft that were sort of backdoor bombers, or was this always going to be an airliner?
Yeah, this was kind of a ploughed its own furrow, really, alongside all those aircraft that were half thought of or entirely thought of as military aircraft. Fokker Wolf had been involved in the airliner business before. They'd made a few small and rather old fashioned sort of regional local airliners, single engine jobs, that really didn't show anything like the way to the 200. Fokker Wolf found themselves sort of going into the mid-30s with kind of spare capacity, because they'd lost the competition for the fighter that became the Messerschmitt 109. They had been providing things like the FW-44 trainer and things like that, and they had a sort of a bit of mid-level business with the Luftwaffe up to that point, but then when you get to the mid-30s, they lose the big one that they were going for, and suddenly there's a bit of spare capacity in the factory. And by this time as well, we're onto Luftwaffe rearmament and modernization, and everything's military aircraft. But then you quickly get into the point where from America you've suddenly got all these modern airliners coming out, notably the Boeing 247 and the Douglas DC-2 and then DC-3. And suddenly you've got the German airline business, which has been doing very well from things like the Junkers 52, very widespread aircraft, very successful aircraft that's not that old in the scheme of things, but it's by sort of mid into late 30s looking very, very dated, and is starting to be quite badly in need of a replacement, or the German industry is going to lose all this business to these interlopers from the States.
And I suppose that's this interesting crux, isn't it? Because like we were saying, the Dorniers and the Druid 8s that we see coming later, nominally airliners that can carry lots of bombs, not many passengers, or some bombs and some passengers. This one is interesting, because in the book you start looking at Deutsche Lufthansa and their requirements as well. And we've talked about the Boeing 247 with Ben Skipper in the past as well, a very, very advanced aircraft that's probably slightly priced out by Douglas, which is ironic considering the backdoor takeover of Boeing by Douglas many years later. Different podcast. But what does... I'm probably going to say Lufthansa a lot just because the abbreviation is DLH. I'm just going to start saying DHL. And that's going to...
Lufthansa is...
So what were Lufthansa after in this aircraft? Because they did buy the American aircraft as well, didn't they? So it's kind of a BOAC thing where they want to buy local but end up grabbing whatever's best out there to be able to compete.
Yeah, I mean, they do get some 247s. But really, there's a lot of sort of mythology around this that it's difficult to kind of tease out sometimes, particularly when it's not in the native language. The popular story is that they were looking for a transatlantic airliner. In fact, what they were mostly looking for was a Junkers 52 replacement, something that could do what the Junkers 52 did, but was more modern, was faster, was more comfortable, could go a bit further, but not huge amounts further, and was just more efficient and had all the sort of modern maintenance benefits and all that kind of thing. So in any other situation, they'd have probably ended up buying DC-3s and being happy about it. But Germany, prestige, a lot invested in the aircraft industry to sell the benefits of advance under science, under National Socialism and all that kind of stuff. It was not a good look for the German flagship carrier to be either falling behind in terms of its aircraft or buying foreign. So there was this requirement for a modern airliner that was essentially a replacement for the Junkers 52. But also, I think there was a sense, certainly coming from Tank, that they could create something more ambitious that would be a bit more attention grabbing and could do some of these publicity-worthy events that were kind of happening. So you have the sort of the Muck Robertson race, which, you know, the DC-2 and the 247, that's a good way to sell them, where they're kind of beating these specialist racing aircraft in a bog-standard airliner. So, you know, there's this idea out there of these long-distance kind of speed and endurance flights with modern airliners, and I think certainly Kurt Tank wants to get into that game, and the Lufthansa management are certainly not averse to getting into that kind of thing themselves as well. So there's an idea that a German aircraft that can compete not just commercially but in terms of publicity and demonstration of the values of the country that it's being developed in and all that kind of stuff, which you get a little bit less of in Britain. It's not so much there that the sort of the industry's commercial products are a symbol of national prestige, if you like. There's a little bit less of that, I think, coming from Britain. But yeah, so you have things like the Junkers 86, the Heinkel 111, the Dornier 17 a little bit. Those are really developed with a dual commercial and military purpose in mind, and that limits their potential as airliners because, as we'll come to later, when you're building a combat aircraft, particularly a sort of tactical one, I mean, the Germans are sort of in a little bit of a muddle at this point as to whether they're doing strategic or tactical bombing, but there's an idea of like these medium bombers, which is the category that they would fit into, are really sort of on the tactical side of things. And you need them to have certain strength factors and to be certainly when you've got Ernst Udet comes in and wants everything to be able to dive bomb, then everything has to be really, really strong. But there's a sense that a combat aircraft has to be stressed really somewhat higher than a purely civil aircraft. And that limits these aircrafts, modern as they are, high performance as they are, it really does limit their potential as airliners. And, you know, they're not that comfortable. The cabins are cramped. You know, you have sort of things like step over spars to get into the cabin and stuff like that. And they're not designed in that way. They're kind of, the idea is that they're kind of shoehorned into that role a little bit, and, you know, using them as mail planes or airliners with, you know, for very small numbers of people, really, they're not ideal, and they're not really the kind of thing that can sell Nazi Germany as this kind of advanced modern country in the way that a dedicated airliner can. So this is what Lufthansa is looking for when it submits this requirement for an airliner in the mid-30s.
Let's get on to the FW200 Airways, because it comes together quite quickly once that requirement comes out, doesn't it? So Tank's not holding around, Fokker Wolf's not holding around, because, as you said, they have this need to be selling something. So let's, for the dear listener and viewer, let's describe the thing, because it is a pretty aircraft. And it's got similar sort of lines to what de Havilland would do with the Albatross a few years later, isn't it? It's that sort of very sleek, quite sort of, I want to say, pointy style of airliner that everybody would quite recognize as an airliner, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the first really modern looking airliners, I think, that looks like an airliner in the way they still do today in many ways. It's got that sort of slender spindle shaped fuselage with the sort of, you know, to the sort of coming to the pointed nose, and it's got these sort of slender tapered wings, which, you know, obviously aren't swept the way they are now, but there was, you know, it must have looked really, really unusual and elegant in a way that the airliners didn't at the time. It really did have these very high aspect ratio wings, which are sort of associated with gliders and things like that, which aren't, you know, they sort of scream efficiency. It gives good range. It just, you know, it gives good lift. And, no, it's a sort of basic of aerodynamics that the higher aspect ratio a wing is, the more efficient it is. And it's just, you know, obviously there's a whole lot of complexity underneath that. And again, a sort of a slender, sort of fairly low frontal area, fuselage, just, you know, low drag. There's no lumps and bumps sticking out of it as an airliner anyway. Obviously, it'll get plenty of those as a combat aircraft. But it's just very clean and very sort of well-designed in that. And it's, in some ways, it's less modern than the Douglas DC-2, DC-3, because, you know, there are panels in the outer wing that are still fabric-covered. And yes, it is an all-metal structure, but there's still parts of it which are sort of steel tube. It's very much a semi-monocoque. Parts of it are stress skin, and as I say, you've got sort of fabric covered sections of the wing and things like that. So it's pretty state of the art, but it's not a step beyond. You know, obviously it's not pressurized either. Which was not 100% necessary for airlines at the time. That sort of added a lot of weight and complexity, which was not something that Tank wanted to go into. And it's four-engined, which obviously the American ones were two-engined. They're two engines of slightly higher power, so you're looking at sort of, what, 1,200 horsepower per engine on the Douglas, certainly. The Condor comes in with engines of just under 1,000 horsepower. Four engines of just under 1,000 horsepower. But then you've got this dependability of four engines, and, you know, it gives you more possibilities for crews and things like that. And it means it makes for a larger aircraft, which you can then either fill it with fuel or with passengers, and it gives you choices. Yeah, I mean, it's following the American airliners a little bit. They were the really groundbreaking ones, but this is, when you compare it to things like the Junkers 52, which is coming after in terms of German aircraft, and it's doing things differently. It's not a carbon copy. So you've got the four engine layout and just a low wing layout and things like that. And it's just, they pay a lot of attention to the cabin layout. So you've got things like, the cabin is split into two, so you've got a forward and aft section. So you can have a smoking section and a non-smoking, which was something they built in from the start. From quite early on, the aircraft had a dedicated steward, and they were this was the first airliner that was routinely operated with a dedicated steward on every flight. So there's these sort of modern touches of the modern airliner really starting to come in now, and it was a great deal more comfortable than the Junkers. You don't have, it's a very comfortably appointed cabin. You don't have this you don't have the sort of structure showing through the way you do with the tri-motors and things like that. It's all very you know, well appointed and in booths almost, where you've got across a table in the first class cabin where the passengers are facing each other rather than in sort of bus like seats. So it's, you know, it does look rather modern. But it's, and it's a good compromise between, between sort of flexibility and performance and capability. So you've got this, you know, you can operate it as a luxury airliner, you can operate it as a long range airliner. If you use one of the cabins for additional fuel tanks, then you can carry a small number of passengers, six passengers, say, a very long way. Or you can carry a sort of 22, 23 passengers, still a reasonably good distance.
What sort of, what is a reasonable distance? How far? Because, you know, the sort of narrative is to keep Argentina and places like that in contact due to the high densities of expats and things like that. Is this designed for that sort of route, or are we talking more European sort of thing?
I think initially it was certainly more European, but it does have this, because it's got the possibility to operate in a long range configuration. You're talking about but just under 2,000 miles possibility, whereas the Douglas, I think, tops out at around 1,500. So we're not talking about drastically further, but a good step further. And there is, it does open up these possibilities for the South American run. And also things, as you see later on, there's the airline in Manchukuo that wants to operate a kind of linking airline from Manchuria to Germany, or to Europe, certainly, which doesn't turn out in the end because of the inconvenient war in the way. But you know, it's opening up some of those global possibilities that weren't really that available with anything other than flying boats, which were very inconvenient and tended to have these sort of very short legs. So you take a week getting to some of these places because of all the stops and layovers and refueling. Whereas with something like the Condor, you could be shortening that to a couple of days. So I think it would have been interesting to see what it did open up had the war not got in the way. Because I think it was, there were some kind of global communications possibilities that the aircraft offered, which weren't really. But yeah, I mean, the main thing was Europe. And this was after Lufthansa, and I dare say we'll get into this, but after Lufthansa did the long distance publicity flights, all the route proving stuff really was around Europe and to places like Latvia, which were sort of very much on the German radar within that sort of orbit of what kind of Hitler had his eye on as a sort of German sphere of influence. But yeah, I mean, that was, so I think really after that, you know, you hear a lot about the transatlantic stuff and the Far East and things like that. And there was that angle that was offered. And obviously the first airline that bought the first non Lufthansa airline that bought aircraft was DDL from Denmark. So, you know, it was, I think it would have been a very prolific aircraft in Europe as well as doing some of those longer range things.
So I take it Lufthansa were quite happy when they finally saw the aircraft and could see what it was doing.
Yeah. I mean, everything I've seen suggests that they were, they were more than happy with it, really, that it was, other than the usual sort of kind of developmental stuff. So, you know, you see the flying surfaces change slightly. The wings acquire, the outer wings acquire that slight sweep back. The tail, the vertical tail is made a bit bigger. But other than that, through that development, which is really quite rapid for an aircraft of this modernity, they seem to be quite happy with it. And they've ordered a number of them and they're ordering more, which again is partly how it gets into Luftwaffe service so quickly is because Lufthansa have been ordering a second batch or further batches of it to meet their needs. And I think they probably would have operated it in quite large numbers had the war come along a couple of years later or not at all. So yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, so obviously there was probably a sense in which they were going to have to order this aircraft politically, but everything I've seen suggests that actually it was the airplane they wanted.
Let's put some dates on this, which we haven't done really yet, have we? So RLM issues the spec in 36, and it's flying by when? Is it late 37, I want to say?
Or is it really? That sounds right. Yeah. Sorry. Excuse me.
Dear listener, both of us have immediately grabbed the book because we've spent more time preparing the KG4D stuff than we have the Lufthansa things. So, yeah, it's a remarkably quick development, isn't it?
I have to tell you, like, dates and stuff like that fall out of my head. As soon as the thing comes out in print, all of the facts and figures just fall right out of my head. But yes, so 27th November. 37.
Well, it's in. Yeah.
Well, yes, late 37, it's flying. And then it's doing its test flights sort of throughout 37. The other development aircraft are appearing, and you know, into 37, 38, when it's doing the, you know, they're really trying to sell it to other airliners and doing these publicity flights. So,
The publicity flights are interesting because that's where it runs straight into good old-fashioned protectionism, especially in the United States, isn't it? So Lufthansa take this thing and do the tours that we still see with new aircraft today, that they'll do all the big air shows. They'll fly around in launch customer colors. You know, I think of the 787 that's at Pima in ANA colors that very rarely flew for ANA, but it went everywhere in ANA colors. Mm. They do a similar sort of thing with this, don't they? And when they get to the States, it all starts getting a bit tetchy.
Yeah, which I found surprising, actually, because this is 1938 when they want to Kurt Tank, again, is very keen on these sorts of flights because they're really selling Focke-Wulf. And also possibly being a little bit stung in missing out on some of the military contracts. He's really pushing this. So they want to do a circumnavigation. Is the story, and the first leg of this will be a transatlantic flight, which is because there are no conventional airliners in straightforward transatlantic service at this time, so it would be a big deal to get an airliner to be able to do this transatlantic flight. And the story is that they were refused the necessary permissions and overflight permissions to the kind of landing rights and overflight permissions to carry out this circumnavigation, and that they had to then sort of use a little bit of subterfuge because they had some licenses for sort of route proving flights that were intended to be carried out by flying boats, but they slotted the 200 into one of these in order to allow it to do the flight to Floyd Bennett Field, and set a sort of speed record across the Atlantic and things like that. So this surprises me slightly, because obviously there's an awful lot of geopolitics going on at this time, we're into 1938, so Munich crisis territory, and I don't think anybody is under any illusions anymore about Hitler's territorial ambitions and sort of some of the stuff that's going on there. So that kind of, there is an element of that, but on the other hand, I think there was still a certain amount of favorability towards Hitler in America generally. He wasn't sort of the universal bogeyman.
Politic way of putting it, my dear Matt.
Well, quite. And so this also surprises me in particular, because the year before that, the Soviet aircraft, the Tupolev ANT-25, had done the sort of transpolar flights and set the distance record by landing in California.
See another Matthew Willis article for more on that.
Well, yeah, but it's like, and they'd been welcomed, and the pilots had been sort of wined and dined at the White House and things like that. And this is the Soviet Union, which I think many in America at the time, as well as later on, really saw as their natural enemies. So it's this kind of surprised me that just a year later, everything's very much more protectionist and nationalistic almost in the way that they're treating this sense. And maybe they just didn't want the competition to the Douglas and the Boeing, you know, but it is interesting. And obviously I think there's a certain amount that, you know, what was a kind of Cold War between the US and the USSR in the 30s, there was more of a sort of detente around that time. And then obviously with just a year later with Hitler is a very, very different kind of scenario. But yeah, that is interesting with the politics. And then there was the idea that afterwards they would go on and do this sort of Far East tour and things like that. And then the prototype crashes, which it ditches and it has a landing. The engines lose power on takeoff and it ditches it in Manila. And this is kind of embarrassing. But it doesn't really harm the aircraft's prospects. It's still got its its export sales. Nobody's actually placed orders, cancels any. Possibly there's the Dutch airline that's looking at it that then doesn't buy any. The first prototype, it's not in bad shape after the ditching, but then it gets wrecked when they're recovering it. But by then you've got the sort of the additional prototypes and the early production aircraft are not far off, so it doesn't really hit the program too hard. But Tang is furious, and you know he's determined to sort of blame pilot error and stuff like that rather than admit to any sort of technical fault with the aircraft. So
he's an incredibly modern sort of designer, isn't he, Tang?
Yeah.
The excuses he comes out with, you sort of think could be in a Boeing press release.
Well, yeah. I mean, you'd imagine what his relationship with the regulator would be like these days, and I'm sure it would be very cozy. But the aircraft's given a clean bill of health, and they get on with marketing it quite aggressively. So they're getting into. There's this first phase of 10, you know, A0 series aircraft, which are the sort of the first production model, and then there's the a B model that's in development and planned and has lots of improvements and has a kind of increased all-up weight and more engine power and various developments that would have made it a more capable airliner than the initial one. So I think then again, quite soon we would have seen a step up in what the aircraft could do in terms of payload and range.
Now, the Luftwaffe are looking at it about the same time, is it? So we're getting into the war here.
Mm.
How do they see the aircraft in comparison to the Dornier 17, Heinkel 111, Ju 88, think 87, 88, those sorts of things? How do they start looking at the Condor as an aircraft that they can make use of?
Initially, it's purely as a transport aircraft. Mm-hmm. And they are prepared to order it in reasonably large numbers, as a long-range transport, because they've got loads and loads of Junkers 52s, but nothing more modern or with a longer range. So I think they think it would be helpful to have these aircraft in the transport role. So probably they're thinking of it in terms of airlift is the closest it's going to get to combat. Yeah, and just sort of long range transport into. So there's this idea that they're going to be fighting a war some distance away, and that people are going to be need to be supplied at some range. So it's just, I think this is where their initial interest comes from. And then obviously you get into the war, and they're in a war with the UK. And certainly the first sort of salvos of that war involve things like the Graf Spee episode, which are kind of before the, you know, when we're still into the, what people at home are calling the phony war, there's this kind of global war going on, this kind of commerce war. And the Luftwaffe has nothing whatsoever to do long-range reconnaissance. And also it doesn't really have a long-range, not a maritime reconnaissance, an actual just long-range pure reconnaissance capability as well. So initially when they're looking at the 200, one of the purposes they're looking at is a long-range photographic reconnaissance platform. And this never really comes off because of the need for it in maritime reconnaissance. But the first sort of properly military adaptation of it is as a photo reconnaissance. And it's kind of, one of them is appropriated by this, or a couple of them, I think, are appropriated by this special unit, which is actually is sort of covert secret reconnaissance unit. That's, what do they call it? The courier staffel, which is kind of how the aircraft gets one of its names, which is sort of this idea that it's like a kind of, you know, it's just for sort of transport and it's for communications and mail and stuff, whereas actually they're, you know, taking these cameras off and photographing things like the anchorage at Scapa Flow. And sort of, so this is the sort of, there's a brief period where this is the way the military Condor might have headed if it wasn't needed for other purposes. And then you've had this battle really between the Navy and the Air Force ever since the Luftwaffe was set up and Goering was involved as to who has control over maritime operations. And the Navy wants its own air arm, and there's been this kind of to-ing and fro-ing for years over what aircraft they'll get and how many of them they'll get and what air crews they'll get and how much control they'll have over them by operationally. And they keep kind of making some progress and then getting knocked back. But they do have this, they do have a bit of freedom at this point, and some officers within the Luftwaffe who are sort of looking into the problem of maritime reconnaissance, certainly as it's fitting the war at the time with these surface raiders and getting into U-boats a little bit in terms of monitoring the shipping and the communications routes and being able to coordinate with the Navy and to act as reconnaissance for the Navy. So Edgar Peterson, who has been empowered to acquire some aircraft and to develop this capability that the Luftwaffe is seriously lacking. I mean, it's got its short range flying boats. It doesn't have anything land based long range. It doesn't really have anything of the kind that's with the sort of capabilities that they really need. It's just all sort of very much coastal stuff that they've got at the time. So he goes around to look at the possibilities, and there aren't many. And he comes to the conclusion that there are two aircraft that more or less fit the bill. So there's the Junkers U-90. It was developed as a bomber, and then it was the 89, and then into an airliner. And then there was a sense of trying to turn it into a bomber again. And that aircraft will pop up again. Versions of it will. And there was the Focke-Wulf 200. Of the two, the 200 was the only one that was currently in production and had a production line, which was really the thing that told particularly in its favour. And there were a number of them available at the time. I think there probably were a couple of Junkers U-90s available, but they would have needed to start up the production line again to get those. And Peterson needed something yesterday. He needed an aircraft that was just that would be available very, very soon. With sort of minimal modifications for maritime reconnaissance. So really stick a couple of defensive guns on it, hang a couple of bomb carriers on it to drop the odd bomb according to its own right. But really they need something with the range that can just get out there and use the Mark One eyeball and look at what's going on out on the distant ocean. This process is helped somewhat by the fact that Focke-Wulf appear to have done some work on developing a military version of the Condor as a very speculative effort for the Japanese Navy. Now, there's various versions of this, and you see lots of stuff in the published sources about how they'd already built one for the Japanese Navy, and the Japanese Navy had requested it, and the first one was for the Japanese Navy, and the Luftwaffe just took it over, and that's not the case. It never got very far with the Japanese Navy. Japan bought some Condors for very much for civil use. Kurt Tank, again, ever the salesman, was keen to try and break into this market in a military sense because the other German manufacturers were selling stuff to Japan. But the Japanese, they weren't really interested. And the Japanese Navy, they were dealing with Junkers and they were happy with Junkers, and that was as far as it went. But they'd done some preliminary work on this, on various adaptations. So things like adding the defensive guns, the Rumpfwanne, or fuselage tub, generally known in English as the gondola, which I avoided using the term in the book just because the German term for engine nacelle is gondeln, literally gondola. So I didn't want to confuse or annoy the people whose country this aircraft came from. So I thought I would use the word closer to the one that they would use, which is tub, because this thing looks like a bathtub stuck on the underside of the aircraft. So there was a bit of design work to militarize the thing, which probably helped bring it into production and availability for Peterson soon. And, you know, it was really, the first one was kind of almost in a matter of weeks. And, you know, there were sort of some sort of adaptations of airliners. They took on a couple of the airliner models to sort of get things going. But then really very soon, sort of, you know, into not that far into 1940, they had the first C model military version, which was a kind of a halfway house, but it was the military adapted version. It had the tub, it had the turrets, it had sort of, you know, capability to drop bombs and various bits of military equipment and stuff like that. And the other thing it had, which probably helped with the development, was the modification for the long range flights had involved filling the cabin just with large fuel tanks. So these large rectangular devices that just sat on either side of the aisle down the cabin. And this is very much what the military Condor was like. The area that in the fuselage that would have been the forward passenger cabin just had these 8 fuel tanks just sitting inside the aeroplane. And it looks really rudimentary. It looks sort of just like an afterthought, but that's what enabled the aircraft to have this prodigious range. You know, they didn't feel the need to bring in anything more cohesive into the design. Just these big tanks sitting on the floor in the middle of the cabin, which I have to say, you know, I'm not sure to what degree they were self-sealing and there wasn't a great deal of, you know, you can't protect that amount of fuel really with huge amounts of armor. So I think I'd have been a bit nervous had I been a crew on one of these things.
Would have been quite fumey inside.
I think it probably would have been extremely fumey. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I'm flicking through as I've not put the little post-it in the
picture of your
cabin. It's literally 8 tanks that you sort of weave your way down. And left to right of where the turrets and the tub would be.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I don't have a photo of it in the book, but I do have the diagram, which is...
Page 136, dear listener and viewer.
There you go. Yeah. Which shows the position of the fuel tanks within the cabin, which as I say, I mean, it's... All I can say is it's as rudimentary as it looks in the diagram. They're just sat there. and that's it. So was it 6 tanks in the cabin and then some others in the wing. And that's it. And there was also the potential for sort of auxiliary tanks within the tub as well. If they weren't carrying bombs, if they were just doing pure reconnaissance, they could put more tanks in that and just wring miles and miles out of this aircraft. So, I mean, it was a fairly minimal adaptation, but it was what they needed when they needed it.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we're at the Pima Air and Space Museum in our Hangar 5, which with more World War II aircraft. The aircraft behind us is a consolidated PB-4Y2 Privateer, which was a Navy patrol bomber derived from the consolidated B-24 Liberator. As you notice, there's massive differences between this and the Liberator. The fuselage looks kind of the same, but it's actually an extended fuselage because there's more crew we need for, like, radar operators and other additional crew members that were on the Navy patrol aircraft. It also did not have superchargers on the engines because they didn't fly at higher altitudes like the B-24 did, which also allowed them to rotate the engines 90 degrees. You also notice it has a single tail versus the twin tail on the B-24. The other thing that's interesting in this aircraft, too, is just its armament loadout is a little bit more. It has 2 top turrets. It has a nose turret, tail turret, and 2 actual powered side turrets. They were essentially used for patrol bombing, which would be, you know, searching for and attacking Japanese shipping and Japanese submarines, as well as bombing Japanese-held islands. This aircraft is an actual combat veteran. It flew out of the Aleutian Islands for the last few months of the war, doing patrol missions over northern Japan and bombing the Kuril Islands north of Japan that are a series of islands that have always kind of been contested between Russia and the Japanese. A bunch of privateers were modified after the war as fire bombers. They were given different engines and usually had their guns all taken off and were heavily modified to fight fires. They were using them up until I think about the early 2000s when they started retiring them because of metal fatigue and issues that they're having with the aircraft that had been flying for 50 years plus and also very bad environments. I've always thought this is a pretty unique aircraft. It's one of the only, this is the only privateer currently on display that has been modified back into its patrol bomber variant with the proper engines and all the turrets and all the radar and antennas on it. So externally, this looks like it did in 1945 when it was flying combat.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And now, back to the show. The book covers the entire service of the war. So you've got Norway in there, you've got invasion of Russia, the Stalingrad airlift, and then the various very interesting adaptations of it with the radar systems put in the nose, the drones as well, the fire bombs. We're not going to talk about that because the bit everybody knows about and probably tuned in for is operations out of Brittany with KG-40. And they're the ones who famously scared the pants off the Royal Navy in 1940-1941. So I thought it would be more fun chatting about that, because by the end of this conversation we're going to be talking CAM ships and Winkle-Brown. But what we need to talk about first is the deployment of KG-40, who were desperate for long-range aircraft to supplement what they were doing. They also get the fantastic marine versions of the A-8 as well. FW-190 with the extra tanks and the pods, different podcasts. I love that airplane. Anyways, how do KG-40 and Herr Peterson make use of this aircraft? Because it's scarily effective, again, for a very small force of aircraft. Because it's not that many, is it, that get deployed?
No. And initially there really aren't that many. There's really just a handful of aircraft that they're operating. It does increase slightly. For a lot of the early period, they're not even into double figures of aircraft operating at any one time. And really, so they use this is that there are sort of big patrol areas there. So there's the Bay of Biscay is an important one, which is covering the Gibraltar convoys. And that section of the Atlantic convoys, and then there's the north. There's the sort of northern area off Norway. So the water's kind of heading up to Iceland and Russia and that sort of area. So there's two big patrol areas that these small number of aircraft really can patrol, and they can cover a vast amount of territory. And again, this is where you come into the sort of the politicking between the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine, where the Navy wants them to be doing reconnaissance for their U-boats and surface raiders, and the Luftwaffe commander pressuring them to do stuff by themselves. And initially, they're carrying out these quite effective attacks on ships, you know, on convoys. There, if you get two or three condors, they can do an immense amount of damage to merchant ships just by attacking them themselves. So either mostly with bombs, just with dumb bombs. They don't have a particularly effective bomb site. You know, talking about the Norden bomb site lately and everything, they don't really have a bomb site at all. So they're just coming in at masthead height and, you know, dropping these things at you know, aiming almost like you'd aim a gun. Just point the plane at the ship, fly as low as you can, release as late as you can, and they're remarkably effective. They sink a number of ships, you know, damage a series of ships sort of in the second half of 1940, the early months of 1941. February 41 particularly is just, they're sinking ludicrous numbers of ships for the number of aircraft that are available to them. And this is what, like you say, it scares the Admiralty. It gets everyone really quite concerned and running around to develop all these means of countering them. Some of them are quite straightforward, fitting more guns to the ships, because in the early part of the war, the merchantmen are very, very lightly armed. Some of them aren't really armed at all. Some of them just with a couple of small machine guns or very, very dated First World War era weapons. And then when they start putting it, you know, even just a couple of 20 mil cannon on and things like that, it changes the picture quite significantly. But certainly in this early part of the war, there's not really any defence against them. It's you know, they sink the Empress of Britain, I think it's in October 40, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, a big ship, quite heavy loss of life. Or they damage it, you know, beyond saving. I think it takes the Royal Navy by surprise. It takes the RAF by surprise. It probably takes the Luftwaffe and the Kriegsmarine by surprise a little bit as well, because this just hadn't been thought of. I don't think anyone would have thought that an aircraft like the Condor could do so much damage by itself. Obviously, it had this...
I'm probably jumping to the next point, really. Mm. That sort of friction between the Kriegsmarine and the Luftwaffe, were they coordinating attacks, or was it being used as spotter and a tackle that was there, or were they trying to draw in U-boats as well? Was there a plan, or was there still competition?
There was a struggle really the whole time the aircraft was operating it, and the tide went backwards and forwards as to who had greater operational control over the units and what they were doing. The victory that the Kriegsmarine gets is this unit called Fliegerführer Atlantik is set up, which is sort of, it's within the Luftwaffe, but it's responsible for operations over the Atlantic area. And the people who are involved in that are quite on board with the mission. So they're less interested in the Air Force doing its own stuff and actually more working more in a coordinated way. And things do keep, they pull backwards and forwards constantly, but you know, from this point really in sort of 41, late 41, it settles down a bit more. This coincides as well really with some of the countermeasures that come in against the Condor acting directly against shipping, make it somewhat less survivable. So you have these two factors that make it, that it swings more into a sort of reconnaissance and control role and directing the U-boats onto the convoys rather than attacking itself. And I think there was always a sense in the Navy that it could do more damage by directing the Navy's assets rather than acting in its own. And to an extent, I think there's some truth in that. You know, once it's made one attack, that's it. Whereas mm-hmm. it can loiter for a long time and be quite useful. And it can stand off a convoy and stay out of the range of its defences. It can hide in cloud rather than when it's actually attacking ships, then it's more vulnerable to the fighters and to the flak and all that kind of stuff. So it gets into more of this role where it's doing this sort of directing and reconnaissance role and communicating with the U-boats and putting them in the right place. And that's, I think, probably where it does its greatest damage, certainly in sort of late 41 going into 42. That's what it's doing more of. And I think there'd been a sense almost as well among the British that they feared that if there were more aircraft doing more of this kind of thing, then that would be more of a threat than the attacking, because they were quite easy to defend against. Although it took a big effort to start with to bring in these defences to tackle them, once those were in place, then it never really had the same threat level by itself as an attack aircraft. And then you had things like, it was very limited in the way it could make attacks. So they did start fitting proper bomb sites There was a Loftus 7D and things like that into it, but somewhat late. So it could make high altitude attacks on ships. But again, when you've got small numbers of aircraft, it's difficult to hit something like a ship. And the Luftwaffe never really had a tradition of anti-shipping attack the way the Italian Air Force did. And they actually learned a lot of stuff from the Italian Air Force early in the war. But, you know, the early war anti-shipping efforts of the, which again makes it quite remarkable that the Condor was so successful, because the early efforts with the combat aircraft against shipping were really quite unsuccessful, or rather they needed a huge effort to get a relatively small result. And they learnt more throughout the war. And I think, again, there was a sense that had they paid more attention to it, they'd have been able to do a lot more damage. So things like the development of the torpedo, it lagged a long way behind, and they kind of got that up to a fairly reasonable level by the time it was too late.
That's a good point, because the Germans, Luftwaffe, never had an effective aerial torpedo until, well, there was nothing to drop an aerial torpedo from, was there? There was
with no
carrier-borne aircraft, with no tradition, he says, doing air quotes. They just put all the focus into traditional submarine-based fish.
Yeah, I mean, and again, there was a small effort to develop an aerial torpedo, and again, with this sort of on-again-off-again thing with the German carrier, they did develop the aircraft for it, including a torpedo bomber, but the effort that went into the torpedo was really lacking, and it was a very small development. It was like two guys in a shed trying to figure out the aerial torpedo, and they picked it up in 41 and put a proper development effort into it, but it was, you know, it was late in the day by then, and they were using Italian torpedoes. They bought Italian torpedoes for a while, and then the supply of them dried up. So, you know, there's a document that a sort of rather self-justifying document that a Luftwaffe officer wrote, which kind of blamed the Navy for not putting more effort into it. And saying sort of all the how the aerial torpedo they had was barely any better than a First World War one and things like that. I don't think it was that bad, but you know, it was slow and unreliable. It probably wasn't as bad as the American torpedo was in 1942, to be honest. But you know, so again, there was the inter-service politics played into that, and it was they could have had a decent torpedo earlier on had the services been working properly or directed properly, and there was less politics in the upper echelons of it rather than deciding how to fight and win a war. But yeah, and they did manage to they hung. Sort of up to three torpedoes could be hung off a Condor, and it wasn't the best launch platform, but it was the kind of thing where if you've got three and you're launching them at a ship, you've got a decent spread, so you've got a half decent chance of hitting something. By the time they got it sorted, the Condor wasn't really doing very much in the direct shipping attack role at all, and there were one or two attacks, but they didn't lead to any results, and by that time they were sort of moving on from the Condor, and the Condor was moving on from that kind of thing anyway.
Let's start heading towards the end, because one of the things that's always come up with Condor is this fragility of it. You talked about it snapping in half on landing and things. It was a beast to actually take out of the sky, as dear Eric found out, as one very nearly killed him. It was a lot tougher than sort of the armchair historians put on, isn't it? Because it's from an air-to-air perspective, it's covered in machine guns. It's designed for longish range, sturdy flight operations out of probably not the best airfields anyways. And one thing Kurt Tank did was make strong aircraft. So this idea of fragility, where does it come from? And this, because, you know, I've just been Googling while you've been chatting, there are pictures of them snapped in half on airfields, but which you would expect from something that's had a hard landing. But where's this idea come from that it was fragile?
Well, probably a number of sources, to be honest. I think it's pushed by people who want to dismiss the aircraft. And I see this as along the same lines as the whole Typhoon's tail snap off thing. People say that as a way
of... Thank you for that.
Well, you know, I think in narrative terms, it's very similar. And you tend to, you know, with due respect to people that I've discussed this with, the sense I get from people who bring up the fuselage snapping in half tend to be, they have a low opinion of the aircraft, and that's like a sort of, that encapsulates their view of the aircraft. It's like something with which they can just set it to one side and disregard its mm-hmm. value as a war fighting machine. And I think this is very similar to the way the Typhoon Tails thing goes. It's like, you don't have to look any further. Oh, well, if it snapped in half on landing, it can't be any good. And part of it was, it didn't have the same level of structural strength as an aircraft that was designed as a combat aircraft. And you even get this from POW interrogations, where they're saying, you know, it's designed for, like, it's got a sort of strength factor of 2, and, you know, the typical bombers have a safety factor of 8, because it was designed as an airliner. And it's not designed to be thrown around, to be, you know, dropping bombs, to be avoiding, taking avoiding action against fighters and stuff like that, and you know, making steep dives and steep climbs and steep turns and all that kind of stuff. It's just not designed for that. So, you know, that's, I think that's part of where it comes from. Part of it is from the German air crews, who were actually very conscious of this, the structural strength of the aircraft and the limits of the aircraft in terms of what you could put it through. And they did have to maneuver it quite gingerly. And there was an example of an early one, I think, during the Norwegian campaign, where one of the more experienced pilots was actually larking about, chucking the aircraft about over, I think it was Tempelhof, and it just broke apart in midair. It just, you know, it just fell to pieces because it wasn't designed for that kind of treatment. You know, it was designed for civil aerodromes, which, you know, have decent grass. At the time, mainly grass, you know, tarmac was coming in. But, you know, you expect a decently smooth surface on a civil air, a nice big aerodrome where you can put it down gently, not a sort of a smaller military thing that might be chewed up or, you know, have bomb holes filled up in it or whatever. So it was being used in circumstances that it wasn't entirely designed for. But I think there was a period early on in its use where the C-1 model was a very, very limited modification of the B model, which would have been an airliner and turned into a transport aircraft. It really just had the military stuff stuck on it, and that was that. The C-3 and thereafter had more fuselage strengthening, and they had more airframe, a bit more strengthening. And I think probably there was also the crews learned a bit more about how they could treat it. And how to use it, because I think there was that inexperience early on as well. And there was a case of a couple of them heavy landing snap in half. And I don't even know if those might have been cases where the aircraft was damaged and making a landing under difficult circumstances or something like that, or, you know, whether it ran into a shell hole. And if you look through the losses, we should mention Chris Goss, who is the master, the Focke-Wulf 200 master. I'm just kind of dipping my toe in the aircraft, but, you know, he's written a lot on the aircraft. And one of his books, which is The Condor at War, 1939-1945, which is from Beautiful Classic. Very good book. Different kind of book to mine. You know, my book has selling points as well, but we'll get into that. Has a list of combat losses, and a lot of the early ones are landing and takeoff damage, and that gets a bit thinner as the service goes on. So my sense of it is, early on you had the weaker aircraft and the inexperience in operating it, and possibly they weren't, you know, they were operating in the Norwegian campaign where it was, you know, they were very much on the front line, whereas later on they were more in their established bases. So they were possibly in rougher places as well. But, I mean, but my point about the snapping in half is this. I mean, it's overdone. The other thing is, the aircraft doesn't get to do what it does if you build it like a combat aircraft. It doesn't have that phenomenal range. It doesn't have the loitering ability, the efficiency and everything like that. It gets all those things because it was designed as a long-range airliner. It's able to cover these huge patrol areas out in the northern waters and the over the North Sea and the Iceland Faroes Gap and then down to the Bay of Biscay and things like that. It's able to cover those vast areas because of its inherent characteristics. And if you build it like a combat aircraft, it doesn't get to do those things. Later on, maybe when you've got more advanced techniques and lighter materials and more efficient engines and stuff like that, maybe you can do that a bit more. But with this aircraft, you've got a choice, and I think the trade-off is they break a bit more often than a combat aircraft would. I mean, it is a weakness, but that was the trade-off to enable them to do what they did, whereas people treat it as a reason it was no good, whereas no, sorry, that's the reason it was good. And yeah, like you say, in terms of, it actually could take a lot of punishment from aircraft, from flak and things like that. You know, they come back with damage. In terms of its structure, it wouldn't stop very much, but it'll keep flying with quite a lot of damage. And given the fact that you can't really maneuver it very vigorously, it gets away with a lot. Considering, you know, fewer than 300 of these things built, and the combat losses weren't crippling. They were moderately heavy given what they were doing, but they weren't, you know, it wasn't so bad that they had to pull the thing out of the sky.
It's that similar situation we've talked with Adam with the C-47.
Mm.
You know, it's a transport aircraft. It's not a fighter bomber. It's not It has its operational window, and it won't get out of that because that's how it's designed, to stay in it and keep the people in the back their drinks in the glasses and the aircraft in the air. So it's a different thing. Let's get to your takeaways from this, because there's only one left, and it's a composite one that Airbus have put back together in Bremen these days.
It's at Tempelhof, I think.
Is it at Tempelhof? Berlin.
I think it's at Tempelhof now. Yeah.
I think
they put it together at Bremen, yeah.
We need a sort of group chat away trip to to Berlin
and totally
do all that sort of stuff. But it's still an incredibly aesthetically pleasing aircraft. They've done an absolutely beautiful job with the recreation, which is a couple different ones and lots of new build.
Yeah.
But having written the book, what's your takeaway from it? Because it's one of those aircraft that does have this savage reputation. Mm. And you do wonder, as I keep saying, trying to get this podcast away from military aircraft, you wonder what this and its subsequent developments as an airliner could have done. Because it is very much on that leading cusp of where Douglas would eventually get with the DC-6 and things like that, Lockheed with the Constellation. You can see that line getting to it. And I think you've got the tangents of the de Havilland Albatross, which was just too damn small. But it's kind of right, isn't it? And it ends up doing something it was probably never intended for. But as an aircraft, it's another one of these ones that Kurt Tank got it.
Yeah, I mean, he got it spot on, really, considering what he was working with and where it was coming from. There was nothing like this in the Focke-Wulf stable before that. I mean, you just look at the previous, and to be honest, there are one or two sort of military designs where you see some of the design cues and some of the shapes and things like that starting to emerge. But this was really just to hit that result straight away, first time designing a large modern airliner, is just astonishing. And then I think the thing that's because you know the story, and you know the story from a certain perspective when you're a British naval aviation writer, but it astonished me just how much damage it did with so few aircraft over a relatively short period of time, but still long enough period of time to really cause some worry. And it really did spark the response in the Allies that was, you know, it was a major and long-term response of developing the escort carrier, which would then turn into this huge asset during the Battle of the Atlantic in the anti-submarine role, and then as a combat carrier for use in amphibious landings and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, but this came out of a response really to one aircraft where they had a few dozen of them. Obviously things like the CAM ship, which is like the closest that I think for British services to be operating something like a suicide weapon, which obviously it wasn't, you know, a lot of them were recovered and so on, but the way it's the fact that it's a one-shot weapon and people did die just from operating the aircraft, you know, they bailed out and they
didn't get picked up.
But the response that it triggered just goes to show the seriousness of it. And I think that I was astonished, even knowing substantial parts of the story, just how much of an effect it had. And then, you know, which we didn't really get to in the, but other parts of the book where its role in certain airlift operations and things like that was actually really major, given the tiny number of airframes that were involved in it. And it was like, it's this aircraft that wherever it goes, it seems to have this sort of outsize effect from a few aircraft are sort of able to really just multiply. It's a force multiplier, as they say, you know, it's a modern term, but yeah, it's just something that you can do an awful lot with a few of them. And that really surprised me in doing this book.
We're going to have to do an episode on the CAM ships and, was it Tim Elkington was a Hurricane pilot? I think he was. That's another show, but we'll have to do this all from the other side. But thank you. I need to give your book more time. I've delve into the bits that I've chatted to Chris about as well, because his Bloody Biscay book is superb on this sort of thing. Even though I tend to read that for the FW-190s, it's another tank aircraft that we haven't discussed directly. Matt, this has been great. What are you working on at the moment? Because I have a couple of lovely copies of your Carrier Aircraft bookazines, and I know there's a follow-up to that. So what is that? That's Carrier Aircraft of the Propeller Area, which is out from Aeroplane, which is really good fun, discussing all the proppy type carrier-borne aircraft. Well, you've just finished the follow-up.
I've just finished the follow-up, which is Carrier Aircraft of the Classic Jet Era. So shocker. That's really going from the first jet landing to really the end of the Cold War. So sort of early 90s. So all that classic, you know, Korea, Vietnam, a lot of the Cold War stuff. Massive fun pulling it together. I think, you know, really quite sort of proud with what I've achieved with it, touch wood. And just, yeah, really looking forward to seeing that one. I hope people enjoy it because, you know, there's it packs a lot in. There's the key bookazines. I like them generally. They pack a lot in, but there's, you know, this proper work.
And plug this one again. What have we been talking about?
We have been talking about Focke-Wulf 200 Condor Eagles of the Luftwaffe, book 2 from Mortons in their Tempest imprint. Yeah, and it's out now, I think $16.99.
Links in the description below, dear listener.
Thank you. Here.
Yes, we make sure we plug it all very much. Matt, it is always a pleasure. I promise one of these times I'm going to give you more notice than about 48 hours of saying, can you pop on the pod?
No, I'm delighted to contribute.
Well, thank you for that. Give Nikolai a cuddle from us.
Yeah, I've got my other half's out. So she arrived on her scooter. She needs my help to get the bike back in. She's been beeping at me for the last 5 minutes.
Right. Thank you, mate.
See you.
As always, I cannot thank Matt Willis enough for answering my panicked calls and jumping on a podcast when I realized that, yeah, I forgot to plan one in for this week. Going forward, we're going to be at the Pima Air and Space Museum next week, so there's not going to be a formal episode, but we're going to be posting a lot of stuff onto our Discord, which is slowly starting to get people on it. I'd like it to be a thing. It's easier than using the Twitters and things like that for sharing direct aviation things. So we're going to be posting lots of little videos and things from the museum on the Discord. They'll be elsewhere as well. But if you want to join us, the link is in the description below. There's like-minded people. Some chat at the moment about Masters of the Air, which we will not be covering too much on the show going forward. Maybe delve into it. But join us on that. Of course, if you want these episodes without the ads, without me plugging too much, there's still a bit of me plugging stuff, join us on the Patreon. £3 a month plus a bit of VAT at the bottom tier. You get everything at all the tiers. You just get to join us, have some fun. We've had our first Zoom social, which was a giggle. We had Scott Marchand from the Pima Air and Space Museum. Next one's going to be April-May time, so there's plenty of time to join up and join the fun. become a damn casteer and help support the show. Of course, as always, tell your friends, like and subscribe, do all those good things, because actually the algorithms work great when you just hit that like or put some stars into your podcast app of choice. The reviews have been lovely. We're going to keep this thing going for, well, as long as my wife lets me, and we'll see how long that is. I am taking her to Arizona, so that's always a good thing. Until next time, everybody, do take care of yourselves. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bone and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.